Hello and welcome to the Real Fix podcast, your fix of real life stories. I'm Hattie Bishop, I'm a journalist and I help people share their stories with the national newspapers and magazines. Plucked from the newsroom, I'll be joined each week by a mixture of my colleagues who will introduce you to some incredible people telling their remarkable stories in their own words. So guys, we're already on episode 7 of the podcast. It's flown by so quickly. We've been really blown away by the feedback and the amount of you who've tuned in so far. It was a totally new thing for us to do, but we love that you guys enjoy being a part of it as much as we do. It really motivates us, and we know it means a lot to our guests to know you appreciate their stories just as much as we do. So thank you so much for listening. This week, we're speaking to a woman who forgot her entire life, including her family and her boyfriend, after she suffered a nosebleed.
I'd pretty much forgotten everything from the 6th of November to me being born. So it ranged from really basic things like how to use a knife and fork to quite important things like my mum and dad's name.
We'll also speak to an inspirational young woman who miraculously survived a car crash after she drunk drove home from a party, but was left paralyzed from the neck down.
One of the guys that was next to me, he did say that I squeezed his hand a couple times, and that's how he knew that I was okay. And you know, who would have ever known that even after the crash and the injury, that man's hand would be the last hand that I'd ever squeeze again.
But first, we're going to hear an incredibly emotional story from a mum from a little village near Aberystwyth in Wales. When Erin kissed her two boys, Zach 3 and Harley 4, goodbye and packed them off for a weekend with their dad, she had no idea all their lives were about to change forever. The boys were caught up in a massive fire inside the caravan where they were staying with their dad, Sean. He tried to pull them both to safety. He fought the inferno and thick smoke and grabbed what he thought were both their arms. But tragically, when he made it out of the trailer, he was only holding one son. Reporter Lucy Bryant spoke to Erin.
The boys had been with their dad from the Friday. He had them for the weekend. And I woke up on the Sunday morning. Quite late, it was about 9:30 in the morning, and my phone had been on silent, and I woke up and had loads of missed calls and messages off some of Sean's family and some numbers that I didn't know, and all, you know, the only message I'd got was to call as soon as I could because there'd been an accident. And then, so obviously I was frantically trying to ring everyone, and I finally got through to one of the neighbours who told me that there'd been a fire in the caravan that Sean and the boys had been sleeping in.
So you heard that there'd been a fire at the caravan, and sort of what's going through your head when you found that out?
Well, everything was kind of a blur. I was asking lots of questions and the neighbour was saying that they've gone to the hospital and that's all they knew. So I rang the hospital and spoke to a nurse who told me that they had Sean and Harley there and they were looking after them and that the police would be on their way to come and speak to me and to wait at home for the police. Because I said, shall I come in? And they said, no, wait at home for the police. So I asked her, you know, what about Zach? Is he all right? And she said, oh, we haven't got Zach here with us at the moment. We've just got Sean and Harley. So, you know, obviously I asked, well, where's Zach then? And she said she wasn't sure and that the police would be here to speak to me soon.
I cannot even imagine how scary it must have been, one, knowing that two people you love so dearly are in the hospital with obviously burns from a horrific fire, and then also there's another son unaccounted for. What's going through your head at that moment while you're waiting for the police to arrive? Because they took sort of 40 minutes, so that's sort of a long time for you to sit there and wonder what the hell's happened.
Yeah, so initially I just knew, like I had a feeling. We were trying to wait for the police and it seemed like forever. Just didn't know what to do, kind of thing, like wandering around and Then yeah, after about 40 minutes, they arrived.
And what did they say to you when you opened the door to them?
The first thing they said was, as you know, there's been an accident, and they said, we're really sorry, but Zach has passed away.
I can't even imagine how horrible that must have been. And what do you, as a mum, I can't even imagine the reaction to being told that one of your sons has passed away.
Well, even though I knew it from when I spoke to the nurse, it was still like a shock to hear the words. And I just remember I just fell to the ground, and was just, I remember just shouting and screaming. And then all of a sudden there was just all these questions, and I was like, you know, well, where is Zach? And the police lady said, well, he's still in the caravan. So he was actually still just a mile up the road from me the whole time, which was the hardest part, I think. I remember shouting at the poor police lady, telling her to go and get him, and, you know, why have you left him there? And the police said that I couldn't go up to the caravan, and there was nothing I could do here, so I needed to make my way to Bristol, which was where Harley had been transferred to by air ambulance.
I guess if you couldn't be with Zach, then Harley needed you and needed your support. And what did they tell you about Harley when you got to Bristol to see him at the hospital?
When we arrived, they were really nice. They took us into a little room in the intensive care unit and sat us down, and kind of she explained to us as much as she knew at the time and what to prepare ourselves for, and like what the situation was, which was that Harley was critical and they didn't know the extent of his injuries or whether he would make it or not.
When you say that they were preparing you for seeing Harley, what did they say? What did they tell you to expect when you were sort of finally saw him?
Well, they said, you know, there'd be a lot of machinery and equipment, because Harley was in an induced coma, so he was on life support, and that there'd be, you know, a lot of noise and a lot. He'd be very bandaged up. She warned me that his face was burnt, so to prepare for that.
And I imagine, obviously, they can tell you a lot to try to prepare you, but when you first saw your son sort of strung up to the machines and obviously covered in burns to sort of 40% of his body, which, as you said, to his face, to his chest, back, arms, legs, hands and feet, like, that is a huge amount for a very small person to have to deal with. For you as a mum, then seeing for him for the first time, how was that?
It was a relief to see him, because I hadn't seen them since the Friday, and it was a relief to just be with him. But it was so scary, and it just, imagining the pain he must have been in. The doctors were really good. I kind of said to them, look, just give it to me straight, kind of thing, you know, there's no need to pretty anything up. And they said, it's very touch and go. They said it's not even hour by hour at the moment. It's more minute by minute.
Just so scary. Yeah. I can't imagine how it must have been for you, especially sort of, you weren't there, so you had to sort of try and piece it together. When you finally got to speak to Sean, obviously he was there with the boys when it happened. What did he tell you about that night?
He, you know, he just said he didn't know what had happened. He said he just woke up and everything around him was on fire, and, you know, that he didn't really remember, that he just went into, as you would, like, into pilot mode. So I had a lot of questions, but I also didn't want to bombard him with questions, which was hard, because I wanted answers, but I knew I couldn't get them.
What were the questions that you did have for Sean, and if you did eventually ask them?
So obviously I said to him, I said to him, how did the fire start? And he said he doesn't know. So I was obviously like, did you have a heater on? Was your phone charger plugged in? You know, all these things that I was thinking it could have possibly been. And he was like, I don't know how it started. So I was like, right, okay. And, you know, the one biggest question was, well, why didn't you get Zach out? You know, and I think that was a hard question. Obviously, it would have been. It was a hard question to ask, never mind to answer. And, you know, all he could say was that he'd tried. Sean had come out of the caravan and he was holding Harley's arm and Harley's leg, and he thought that he was holding both Harley and Zach, and it wasn't until he was out of the caravan and going into the house with Carrie and Harley that he realized that it wasn't Zach, it was just Harley. And his family said that he tried to go back into the caravan to get Zach, but it was totally engulfed in flames by this point.
That for him must have been unbelievably heartbreaking. And then obviously throughout this time, Harley's still in hospital and fighting for his life. For you as a mum, trying to get your head around the fact that you've lost one son and you could potentially lose another one, did you just have to stay positive, or how do you even begin to sort of cope day to day?
It was kind of more of a, you had to be practical, and I had to just not think about too much. Like, my focus was Harley and getting Harley better.
And when he did wake up, one of the first things he said was daddy, wasn't it? And do you mind telling us a bit about that and about sort of what he said about Zach and the fire?
Yeah, so the doctors and things had told us that, you know, when he wakes up, he might not know what's happened, he might not remember, but he might, and we didn't know what to expect. He couldn't really speak. They took his tube out, but because of the burns and the damage to his lungs, he couldn't really speak, but you could tell what he was trying to say. And yeah, he woke up and he just started trying to shout daddy, which was really hard because he, like, just knowing that he must have been so confused. I think it was quite quickly that he said to me, he went, Zach's dead, which we didn't know if he'd know that or not. That was when it kind of hit me the most, was hearing him say it. You know, hearing doctors and police and grown-ups saying it was totally different to hearing Harley saying it. In the beginning, in like the first week or so, he spoke about it quite a lot, and would mention Zach and would keep telling everyone that Zach was dead. And you know, we were reassured that, like, that sometimes kids, that's just how kids process things. But after like a week or so, he stopped really talking about it, and he didn't really mention Zach or the fire or anything really then for pretty much the rest of his hospital stay. So it was just a case of letting him talk about it when he wanted to, but not bringing it up when he didn't want to talk about it.
Yeah, of course. And then 3.5 weeks after the fire, Sean was finally able to visit Harley for the first time since it had happened. What was that moment like?
It was emotional for you know, me and Sean. I think Harley was just so excited to see his dad, and like, it just seemed like nothing had happened. You know, once he saw his dad, he was just really happy. It must have been so reassuring for Harley because it's, you know, the first time he'd seen him, and to see that he was okay.
And now that he's home, sort of, he's doing really well, isn't he, Harley? How is he getting on?
Yeah, he's doing amazing. He has just, from the moment we got home, he's just absolutely thrived. You know, we were worried, like, that not only the physical side of things, but the mental side of things might have been a little different, and that we wouldn't have, you know, the same Harley back that we had before. But he is, I think he's even cheekier than he was before. And he's just doing so well. He just takes everything in his stride. He definitely handles it much better than I think I could of myself.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear it. I know obviously from reading the report, there was, they said that the fire happened just completely by accident. It was no one's fault. Was there ever a part of you that sort of blamed Sean for what happened, or blamed anyone else or anything else for what happened? Or, as you say, was it just something that you've just got to take in your stride and just look at logically?
A lot of it's been phases. You go through phases of thinking, you know, thinking one thing, like, well, it must have been something, there must, you know, it's got to be someone's fault. You want to be angry at someone, but then you go through phases of thinking, well, you know, these things do happen. You just never think it had happened to you.
The cause of the fire is still being investigated. We know that you guys will join us in wishing Erin and her family lots of love for the future. Later on in this episode, we'll hear another tale of survival against the odds when we catch up with Melissa. She was 18 when she went to a party, had a few beers, and then got behind the wheel of her truck, with disastrous consequences she has to face for the rest of her life.
Based on my level, there is a 1 to 2% chance of making recovery after this lesion. And it's amazing that, you know, it's even that, because the beautiful part is it's not zero, right?
Melissa blew us away with her honesty, and I can't wait to share her story with you. But first, we're going to speak to Sophie. She had been with her boyfriend Jonathan for 2 years when she lost all her memory in a matter of minutes. Not only did she forget their relationship, she forgot her own name, her address, and even who her mum and dad were. So, just like the movie 50 First Dates, starring Adam Sandler and Drew Barrymore, romantic Jonathan set about dating her for the first time all over again. The couple from Surrey in South England explained all to our reporter Charlotte Penketh King.
I was getting ready for work, so I was upstairs when I initially got the nosebleed, and I didn't really think anything of it initially. Until about 5 minutes in, I thought, well, this is a bit strange. So I went downstairs to have a little chat with my mum and said, oh, I've got a nosebleed. So we kind of had a little laugh and a joke about it because we didn't really think anything of it. And then about 20 minutes passed and it was still ongoing. But at that point, my eyes started becoming really hazed. And that was when my mum noticed that blood was coming out of my left eye. And very quickly after that, I lost all sensation in my left side subsequently lost my memory at that point.
So when you kind of lost the strength in your left side, your mum then phoned for an ambulance?
Yeah, so I asked her to bring my phone so that she could call for me. But it was at that point that I realised that I had something wrong, because I couldn't remember the code to my phone at all. She was saying put it in, but I couldn't remember what the code was, and at that point I thought something's wrong here.
Yeah. And then the ambulance arrived and they went over a few questions with you to see what your memory was like, is that right?
Yeah, so they went over things like, what's the date, who's the Prime Minister, what's your name, and all those things I couldn't answer.
That must have been really scary to suddenly not be able to remember quite basic things like that.
Yeah, I kind of felt like I was in a dream, if I'm being honest. And the more I think about it now, it felt like I was in someone else's body. It just, it didn't feel right or real.
Okay, so then you were rushed to the hospital and they did lots of tests like CT scans and lumbar punctures, but they were just kind of ruling out things that it wasn't. And then doctors found out that you had functional neurological disorder, so a condition where signals between the brain and nervous system are interrupted or separated. And your main symptom of that was that you'd lost your memory. So what kind of things had you forgotten?
I'd pretty much forgotten everything from the 6th of November to me being born. So it ranged from really basic things like how to use a knife and fork, to quite important things like my mum and dad's name. So it really ranged.
Hmm. And you said you forgot your parents' names, but they were at the hospital with you. So that must have been really surreal. You didn't recognise the family who were with you there?
No. My dad arrived first, and the first thing I said was, "Who is this man?" So the next day it would have been Jonathan. So he came on the Thursday, and my mum had to introduce him to me as my boyfriend.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you and Jonathan, at this stage, you'd been together, 2.5 years? That must have been really strange. I mean, not recognising your parents and not recognising your boyfriend. What was it like for you?
It was really strange, actually. Even when I think about it now, it makes me quite emotional because it's like I was living a different life as such, and the life that everyone else was living, I had no recollection of. It's kind of, I kind of had FOMO, really, I guess, of not knowing who anyone was.
Mm. That must have been really difficult. I mean, it must have felt like that's not really you who they're talking about because you don't have those memories with them.
Yeah, and I still feel like that now, actually, when people talk about things, it now gets to the point where I just agree with them, because there's only so much you can do. I think people forget that you've lost your memory, so they assume that you were going to remember what happened 5 years ago, and then I don't. So
yeah,
there's only so many times I can tell someone I've lost my memory.
Yeah, and was it hard when Jonathan came in? I mean, obviously you'd already been reintroduced to your mum and your dad. It must have been really difficult seeing Jonathan.
Yeah, I struggled with it initially because I wasn't able to do anything for myself. So I had to rely on him and my mum and dad quite a lot at the beginning. So my trust had to go into him straight away, which was quite difficult because you don't often do that when you first meet someone. You don't instantly trust them to feed you, or do you know what I mean? So, yeah, it was difficult.
Mm.
I knew I had some emotional attachment to him, but I couldn't work out what that was. So the feeling of love, I would say, probably was there, but I had no idea why.
Yeah. And then you were in the hospital for 4 days to help with your mobility, and then you were allowed to go home to your parents, even though you didn't really know who they were at that stage because you'd been just reintroduced.
Yeah, so I was in hospital for 10 days, actually, but the 4 days at the end were right. Just for mobility.
Right.
But, yeah, so they sent me home, and I came home to a house that obviously is mine, but I had no idea it was mine.
Mm.
So I was commenting on how pretty the wallpaper was and how big the house was, like I was walking into a stranger's house.
Mm. Rather than the house that you'd grown up in.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. It was really bizarre. Even walking into my bedroom, I was like, oh, this is really lovely.
Well, it's good that you didn't walk in and think, oh, this is horrible.
Yeah, I'd have to change everything.
And how did you and Jonathan kind of work on rebuilding your relationship together then?
I think it kind of happened quite naturally because I relied on him a lot in the beginning. And I think we had a lot of time together to get to know each other again. And I had a lot of questions to ask. I was very nosy. I needed to know what food he liked, what films he liked. So it was kind of like a 21 question interrogation from my end.
And I And did he do anything to remind you of the relationship that you've had that obviously you'd forgotten, but he still remembered?
Yeah, so we made a photo book with all of our memories from the last few years on, so we could go through them. Daily, he would send me, you know, like you get on Facebook, the Facebook memories. He would send me those and tell me what we did on what days. And when I eventually was well enough to go into a car, he took me to like Richmond Park and just showed me around where we'd been. So he did as much as he could.
So he was recreating your dates then that you'd been on before that you couldn't remember?
Yeah, so we recreated quite a few actually. The main one we recreated was Kew Gardens. So we go there every year. So he took me last year in December, and it was definitely a different experience because I was in a wheelchair, but yeah, at least we can say we went. And actually in years to come I will look back on that as a memory rather than a nightmare.
Yeah, and like you said before, that feeling of love was there when you saw him. You knew there was that feeling, but you didn't really understand why. But after spending this amount of time with Jonathan, have you fallen in love with him all over again?
Yeah, I still get the butterfly feeling when I'm around him. I feel like I'm in the honeymoon period again, and he's definitely not. So we're polar opposites at the minute. But yeah, I would say that I feel like I've been able to meet him all over again, which is a really lovely feeling.
That's lovely. And what is it like doing things that you've done before but you're not remembering?
I think it's great for me. I'm getting to do loads of new things. I've started to write a bucket list now of all the things that I did do that I really enjoyed that I'm gonna do again. For him it's probably not so great because it's gonna be costing him a lot more money.
Amazing. And we know that you're doing so well in your recovery and moving forward from this, but you haven't regained those memories, have you?
No. So I've kind of come to terms with the fact that I probably won't get my memory back. So that's taken some time to kind of get used to, but I'm just now focusing on memories moving forward rather than the past.
Yeah, yeah. And how do you think this experience has impacted your relationship with Jonathan now? Has it brought you guys closer or?
Yeah, I think we're probably a lot stronger than we have been. And as I say to him, if we can get through this, which we have, then we can get through anything because this has probably been the toughest time of both of our lives.
An absolutely incredible story there. Sophie and her doctors still don't know exactly why her memory was erased, but they think her nosebleed released a tiny bit of pressure in her brain, which disrupted the signals to her nervous system. And we know you guys love the romantic tales in the podcast, so I hope you loved hearing from Sophie just as much as we did. If you want to read some more incredible stories like that, you can find them on our website, www.real-fix.com. Our final story today comes from Melissa in Florida. She was your average party-loving 18-year-old. One day she went to a party, had a few drinks, and then got in her car to drive home. But it was a mistake that left her fighting for her life with just a 1% chance of survival. She did pull through, but has lost all the feeling from her neck down. She talked to reporter Laura Elvin about the night that changed everything.
So, Melissa, your story actually starts 3 or 4 weeks before the accident. Tell us about the dream that you had before the crash.
At 18 years old, I woke up in the middle of the night and I just had a dream that I had to tell somebody about. Sometimes we have those crazy dreams and I get on the phone and I ring my best friend. And it's like 1 a.m., 2 a.m. It was super early in the morning. And she answers and she says, Melissa, like, can you tell me tomorrow? Like, I'm tired, I'm sleeping. And I tell her, I was like, Kristen, you got to listen to this dream though. I don't want to forget it. And I tell her, I was at this high school and there was thousands of kids. And I don't know exactly what I was saying, but I was talking about drinking and driving and also doing drugs. And she responds and she says, you know, but Melissa, you don't do drugs. And I told her, I was like, yeah, I was like, I know, but whatever I was saying, like the kids were just getting it. Like they were listening to me. And I tell her, I was like, I don't know, but I think I want to do something like that when I grow up. And we hung up the phone. We never talked about that dream again. And then a few weeks later, I would end up putting myself in a position where I'd be given the opportunity to do exactly that.
So at the time of the accident, it's 2008, I think, and you're 18. And like most 18-year-olds, you know, making the best of life, having parties, going out with your friends. And you're just weeks away from going to college. I think you had just been through a breakup and you'd been out the night before. And you weren't really even planning on drinking that night at all. What changed?
Yep. You know, it's hard to pinpoint exactly what it was that changed. But what I can tell you is I was at this house and I was just the people that I was friends with. And, you know, when we got there, they were already drinking. And me and Leanne, who I came with, we knew that we didn't want to drink because, like you mentioned, like we drank a lot the night before and we didn't have any intention of drinking again. So just about an hour after being there and just the guys and wanting to hang out and just play games that involved alcohol, we finally were like, all right, I guess it's just one beer. It's not a big deal. But the problem often for most of us is one drink does not usually stop there.
What do you remember about that decision not to stay and to get behind the wheel? And what made you make that decision, if you can remember?
Well, I got home every other time, right? There's not a single time that I left somewhere from having alcohol that I didn't make it home, right? And so I never once had the thought in my head that, oh, if I leave tonight, I might not make it home this time. I never, ever thought about that. It never crossed my mind.
So tell us about what happened that night that really changed the course of your life forever.
Well, after I pulled out of this guy's driveway, I told them that we'll text them as soon as we get back home and stuff. And I was at this traffic light, and at the light, there was two lanes, but after the light, they'd merge into one. So there was a man that had pulled up next to me at the red light. And after that light turns green, he just starts speeding up. And, you know, it's almost like he was trying to beat me to the merge that we were coming up to. And so he does. He cuts me off at the very last second as his lane was ending. And I started to go off the road a little bit, but I was able to recorrect and I got back on the road. But after he hit the brakes a little bit further down, my back right tire got caught on the shoulder of the road. And my truck after that, it just immediately began to start flipping. And, you know, yes, maybe one can argue that the crash wouldn't have happened if that guy wasn't there or he didn't do what he did or, you know, different reasons. But the reality is I definitely had alcohol in my system. And it unfortunately affects the way that our body operates. Once, you know, my truck started flipping after getting caught on the shoulder of the road, neither one of us had put on our seatbelts for whatever crazy reason. And we flipped about 8 to 10 times is what they estimated. And during the course of that flipping, we both got thrown out of my truck. I landed 75 feet away from my friend. And it looks like I came out of the vehicle first, based on where we landed, and then she landed further right next to where the vehicle had stopped flipping. So the guys that had ended up finding us, they said that if it would have flipped one more time, it would have completely crushed her.
Wow. What do you remember about the accident? Do you have any memory of it?
I remember seeing his brake lights, and after that, I don't remember anything. I don't remember losing control or my truck flipping, but my friend that was with me, she remembers us looking at each other dead in the eyes right before we started flipping, like we knew something bad was about to happen. How I got here is just, it's just the weirdest thing to try to grasp.
Yeah, so I think I remember you telling me that that local people had heard the crash from about a mile away. And
yes,
I hope you don't mind me describing your injuries, but you told me that you were face down and your neck was kind of so twisted that your chin was actually resting on your shoulder.
Yeah, that's what the guys had said. One of the guys that was next to me, he did say that I squeezed his hand a couple times and that's how he knew that I was okay. And, you know, who would have ever known
that even after the crash and the injury, that that man's hand would be the last hand that I'd ever squeeze again.
Wow. When you put it like that, that's incredible. So yeah, I think your friend, she had a broken pelvis and a broken tailbone, but you fared far worse in it. You broke your neck in five places, I think, and it cut your spinal cord and left you paralyzed from the neck down.
Yes, it sure did. And so with the spinal cord, from what I was told, is a bone fragment from, you know, the breaking of the vertebrae. Bone fragment went into my spinal cord. But there are people that break their neck and they don't end up, you know, having any life-changing injuries. But when bone fragment does hit that spinal cord, that right there is the game changer and what creates the function in all of our amazing body parts.
So for people that might not be very familiar, what that means is that you were left quadriplegic. What does that mean in sort of simple terms?
So quadriplegic means, I think quad four, that means all four limbs are affected from the injury. So for me, with the level that I broke my neck, the vertebrae that start from the base of your skull and they go down to where your neck ends, those are your neck vertebrae. And those vertebrae are the ones that deem you as a quadriplegic or not. Anything below the neck would make you a paraplegic, which just means two limbs are affected, and that's your legs. And sometimes even people's torsos, but not their arms or their hands. But since I had broken, you know, my neck, that did paralyze my arms, everything below my chest, all the way down to my toes. Everything was affected, even my breathing, you name it. Thankfully, the only thing that wasn't affected was my brain. The brain injury that I did face, it fully healed. And I just got left with a lifeless body, I guess you could say.
You were obviously rushed to hospital in a coma and initially known as Jane Doe because people didn't know who you were. Your parents were called and they arrived about 3 hours later. And they were given some pretty bleak news about your chances of survival at that point. I think you told me that doctors had given you just a 1 or 2%, had given them for you a 1 or 2% chance of survival and said that even then they really didn't think you'd be able to breathe on your own. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is correct. Based on my level, there is a 1 to 2% chance of making recovery after this lesion. And it's amazing that, you know, it's even that, because the beautiful part is it's not zero, right? And that's exactly the kind of parents that I was raised with, is you don't need 100%, you don't even need 50. But the fact that it was 1 or 2% was enough for us to try to make something out of what I had to wake up to.
It's a pretty pretty good outlook to have, Melissa, and I think that's probably a big part of why we're having a chat today, for sure. Because it wasn't an easy ride for you, and you were in a coma on a ventilator for 10 days. You were transferred to a specialist hospital in Atlanta, Georgia, I think. I guess I'd like to ask you a bit about when you came round, how did you feel? What was going through your head?
So being 18... maybe you're calling my stubbornness, maybe it's a mix of my personality. I don't know what exactly, but I did not believe them, you know? In my mind, I was like, well, people get injured, right? People break bones and they get hurt and they're, you know, in a cast or a wheelchair for X amount of days or months, but they bounce back, right? Like, they get better.
So it's fair to say that, I guess at that point, your mental mode is certainly denial, is kind of maybe the main aspect of that.
Yes. Major denial, and so much in the fact that I remember right before I was going to be getting discharged after being in that hospital for 2 months, they had brought me into a room to look at different wheelchairs. And to go into that room and try to even grasp the reality that something like this was going to be replacing my entire body and everything I've ever known, I just remember I got physically nauseous. I got so sick that I just couldn't even be in there because I couldn't grasp that this really was real. It was very difficult for me to understand that this was going to be the rest of my life.
I guess one thing I'd like to kind of ask you about is, I think there's probably like everybody's, most people's worst nightmare is to hear that, you know, that they're going to be, they're paralyzed from the neck down and that they're never going to be able to walk again. I know it took you a while to kind of accept that news, but what did it feel like when you were told that?
What is the word of what it felt like? To battle something as big and small as just choosing to live again. I didn't know this then, but the price was not going to be cheap, right? This was not going to be an easy feat. Once I realized, okay, this is real, you know, after months had gone by and I was back home and the reality of being home and, you know, everything changing on that level, it became so much more than just not walking again. It's like, wait, I can't even pick my nose again. I can't even wipe my own tears off my face or, you know, like just the simplest task of doing anything you do for yourself, like just completely taken away from you just because I made, you know, a decision that most people by the time that they're 30 have made at least once, right? If someone has a driver's license and a vehicle that they're able to drive, coming home after drinking one night is a choice that most people have made at least once in their life. And to think that that's all it takes, right? It just takes once and everything can be completely stripped away from you.
I think you've hit the nail on the head there. I think lots of people listen to that will have made that same mistake, but with much less disastrous consequences, that's for sure.
Yeah.
And when do you think it did sink in?
Honestly, maybe this sounds crazy, but it took me about 4 years. It took me about 4 years to really get it, to really understand that life was just going to have to be different. In the course of those 4 years, I got exhausted and there wasn't much quality of life with everything being focused on, okay, well, once I can do this again, then life will be better. Or once I can get to this point, then I'll be happy to start living again. I think there's a circumstance that we all have on our plate at some point. It doesn't have to be paralysis. It could be anything, but there's something that we've all got, I believe, that we can't necessarily change right now. But I've learned that, you know, we can't stop living while we're waiting for something drastic to change. I've got to start living again because there's a reason why my life didn't get taken that night. I may not know it yet, but I'm definitely not going to find out what that reason is if I keep staying in this rut and just down and out and just not even living.
And I know, I think anybody listening to this will certainly come away knowing that you are a glass half full person. But I wonder, were there times, and there must have been through your recovery, where you were like furious with anger, and did you ever think, you know, why me, why not somebody else? And were you ever angry about it?
Oh yeah, definitely, because every single one of my friends, every person that I had hung out with, you know, had made that same decision that I made before, like I had mentioned, you know, why does it have to be so drastic for me? Why couldn't I have, you know, become a paraplegic where I still had the upper body function or just something else? Like, why did it have to be this extreme was all I kept thinking to myself. But then, you know, this injury has really given me a heart for humanity and for other people that I did not have before because I was, you know, self-absorbed with just, well, what can Melissa do to have fun? What can I do to have a good day? Or, you know, it was all about me. And again, that doesn't make somebody a bad person, but you're also missing out on the opportunity to help other people and maybe impact somebody else's life.
And this might be a silly question, but if you could go back to that day and change the decision you made about getting behind the wheel, how much of that would you change, or would you change it at all?
See, that's always a hard one, because would I want my feeling and movement back like I used to have? Of course. Like, that would be crazy to say that I want to be paralyzed, you know, like that'd be crazy. But at the end of the day, if that would mean I'm sacrificing everything that I've learned so far, and like I've said, the heart for humanity that I've gained, even with all the physical losses, I wouldn't want to change it, because I don't want to know what kind of person that I maybe would have ended up becoming if I did stay stuck in that pattern of just simply living for myself.
And the accident definitely hasn't stopped you achieving some of your dreams, that's for sure. You know, you've graduated with a degree, you've written a book, you're 30 now, and you're doing exactly what you dreamed about weeks before the accident. And just like that premonition that you phoned your friend at 1 o'clock in the morning, now I know you do that. You go and sit in front of huge amounts of people, kids at school, at college and classes, and you speak to them about what you've been through, just like you kind of dreamt that you would do. What message do you give them, and what do you hope that they take away from it?
So when I speak to these schools, or a lot of my speaking here recently has been to DUI offenders. So these are people that have been convicted of drinking and driving. They've gotten caught. They've been arrested, court ordered to do all these classes, and you name it, it's quite the process they have to go through. But it's cool to relate to them because we made the same decision. And there's no going around that. We made the same decision, whether it was the first time or the thousandth time. We made the same decision. We're just in different shoes. So just to let everybody know, you know, the dangers of what they can do, but also what they can now do after it with this second chance that they were given. I guess you could say also seeing somebody going through something that you would never want to go through also tends to help people pick up what they got left and to just start moving again. You know, I don't know why we're like that, but when we see other stuff that we're like, oh my gosh, thank God that's not me, or I'm not going through that, it kind of helps them be like, all right, this is where I'm at right now. This is what I want to wake up to. What do I got to do to get there?
I know I've heard you actually say to people, look, you know, look at me sat here, do not make the same mistake as me. And that's quite a powerful, honest thing to say, I think.
Yeah, just to own it. And that's one thing I had to make the decision to do. And that happened in those first 4 years that I tell you about the emotional healing, is I had to own that, okay, this was a mistake. I did it to myself. Nobody made me drink that night. Nobody made me try to take the trip back home. You know, at the end of the day, we're our own human. We're going to make our own decisions. But even on that note, as we make our own decisions, I think one of the one things we have to understand is every decision we make isn't just going to impact us, right? Like my entire family has been impacted by my decision, even now, this many years later. But for whatever crazy reason, I was given another chance. And with this chance, Laura, if I could help as many people as possible not end up in my position, then that's what I'm going to live for the rest of my life.
Such a thought-provoking chat there from Laura and Melissa. You can check out our Facebook page, Real Fix, for photos Melissa has kindly shared with us of the crash and of her recovery. And that's it for this week. Thanks to all our guests for sharing their stories with us. If you've enjoyed the podcast, you can find all these stories and more on our Facebook page, Real Fix, and on www.real-fix.com. It would mean the world to us if you could pop on your podcast app and give us a review. Thanks for listening.